We're on page 260 of the book. And the name of it is it's the 26th one called The Noble Search.
Okay, good. Yeah, so we're partway through.
Yeah. And this is when the Buddha is telling everybody the story of his enlightenment. Do you remember it, or do you want me to start at the beginning?
I wasn't here, so I don't remember it at all.
Start at the beginning.
Okay, we'll start at the beginning, 26. In my book, it's page 253. We're actually on 26.
How many?
26.
Yeah, how many are in
to 151. Hard to say. So namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay. Arya Pariyasana Sutta. The Noble Search. Does somebody else want to read, or do you want me to read? What? You want me to read?
Sure.
Okay.
I'll read if you'd like someone to read.
I just, whatever. Doesn't matter to me. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jetta's Grove, Anathapindika's par. Do you want to know what thus have I heard it means? I mean, we've done it before, but we'll check the footnote if you want. Might be something new. Who knows? Maybe it was amended by the editor because he felt like putting it in. $297. Oh, this title follows the... Okay, we're talking about the title. The title is called Different Things in Different Texts. That's what they're saying. But we're not reading a different text, so for the moment this is good, okay? Then when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe went into Sawati for alms. Then a number of bhikkhus went to the Venerable Ananda and said to him, Friend Ananda, it is long since we heard a talk on the Dhamma from the Blessed One's own lips. It would be good if we could get to hear such a talk, Friend Ananda. Then let the Venerable Ones go to the Brahmin Ramaka's hermitage. Perhaps you will get to hear a talk on the Dhamma from the Blessed One's lips. Yes, friend, they replied. Then when the Blessed One had wandered for alms in Sawati and had returned from his alms round after his meal, he addressed the Venerable Ananda. Ananda, let us go to the eastern park, to the palace of Migara's mother, for the day's abiding. Yes, Venerable Sir, the Venerable Ananda replied. Then the Blessed One went with the Venerable Ananda to the eastern park, the palace of Migara's mother, for the day's abiding. Then when it was evening, the Blessed One rose from meditation and addressed the Venerable Ananda. Ananda, let us go to the eastern bathing place to bathe. Yes, Venerable Sir, the Venerable Ananda replied. Then the Blessed One went with the Venerable Ananda to the east bathing place to bathe. When he was finished, he came up out of the water and stood in one robe, drying his limbs. Then the Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, the Brahmin Ramaka's hermitage is nearby. That hermitage is agreeable and delightful. Venerable Sir, it would be good if the Blessed One went there out of compassion. The Blessed One consented in silence. That's how you can tell when you're talking to somebody who's fully awakened. If they agree with you, they don't say nothing. However, sometimes if they think you don't have anything that you want to hear from them, they will also not say nothing. So it can be a bit confusing. However, you can make the choice which you want it to be, because they're not saying nothing. Then the Blessed One went to the Brahman Ramaka's hermitage. Now on that occasion, a number of bhikkhus were sitting together in the hermitage discussing the Dhamma. The Blessed One stood outside the door, waiting for the discussion to end. When he knew it was over, he coughed and knocked, and the bhikkhus opened the door for him. The Blessed One entered, sat down on a seat made ready, and addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, for what discussion are you sitting together here now? And what was your discussion that was interrupted?" You notice how he follows the customs of politeness of the time? You know, he waits outside when people are involved in a discussion, and then he coughs, and you know?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that nice? That whole thing about compassion is when you understand fully, which some lifetime, may all gurus bless me, might happen for this being, or whoever it is I'm making, that you actually respect the states of everything around you. You know, wouldn't that make life easier? Does that make sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, I love those little things in the sutras, those little bits that sort of give you a sense of them as a being walking around. Bhikkhus, for what discussion are you sitting here now, and what was your discussion that was interrupted? Venerable sir, a discussion on the Dhamma that was interrupted was about the Blessed One himself. Then the Blessed One arrived.
Mm-hmm.
Good bhikkhus, it is fitting for you clansmen who have gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness to sit together to discuss the Dhamma. When you gather together, bhikkhus, you should do either of two things. Hold discussion on the Dhamma or maintain noble silence. And you remember that footnote, what that referred to, noble silence? Remember? Wait. Terry's looking it up. Tell me when you found it. Have you found it? So what it means is to be in one of the blissed jhana states, to hold the mind in absorption. Either bring your mind into a state of comfort and ease in the moment, or talk Dharma. What a good idea. That's another thing I want to adapt. Whoever it is I'm making that who will awaken someday. That's another one of my aspirations. Oh yeah, that's not a problem. That's Dharma, isn't it?
Yes.
You betcha. Because there are these two kinds of search, the noble search and the ignoble search. And what is the ignoble search? Here someone, being himself subject to birth, seeks what is also subject to birth. Being himself subject to aging, he seeks what is also subject to aging. Being himself subject to sickness, he seeks what is also subject to sickness. Being himself subject to death, he seeks what is also subject to death. Being himself subject to sorrow, he seeks what is also subject to sorrow. Being subject himself to defilement, he seeks what is also subject to defilement. And what may be said to be subject to birth? Wife and children are subject to birth. Men and women slaves, goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares, gold and silver, are subject to birth. These objects of attachment, so footnote 299, upadani, upadi. The root meaning is foundation, basis, ground. In the commentaries, various kinds of upadi are enumerated. So that's, among them the five aggregates, objects of sensual pleasure, defilements, and kama. Jnani Mula renders the term consistently throughout as essentials of existence, which often obscures its clear contextual meaning. I have tried to capture the several connotations of the word by rendering it objects of attachment. So the ground or basis or foundation sense of being, necessities for being, are just the ground or basis necessities for being. But when there is grasping for them, we're trying to maintain them when they're not there, or, you know, that's what he's talking about. Is that pretty clear? Is anybody doesn't find it clear?
Is there also a sense of trying to get more of them just because you want to get more
of
them?
But that's why you would try to get more of them too, like any kind of grasping for them.
So it's more than what is necessary to maintain your life?
No, it's grasping for them even if you don't have enough to maintain your life. If you don't have them and they aren't available and there's no way you can get them, to grasp after them is not useful. So to be attached to having to have what you can't have, a desire for an experience other than that which is present, is suffering. And it's talking about the grasping after what is unattainable. For example, when I was a child, I was the blonde in a family of brown or black-haired people. So quite regularly, and my hair at that time, believe it or not, was very curly. Quite regularly, and most of the others had much straighter hair. My mother had kind of wavy hair. My sister, one sister had kind of wavy hair, but mine was like ringlets. Blonde ringlets. And every night or day or several times a day when I was about five, I used to think, okay, because I was very interested in religion, and then I was told that there was a God by some friend of mine whose family was Baptist. So I used to decide I would pray to God that I would wake up in the morning with straight black hair. Because obviously that was beautiful. I just had to look at my family. It was perfectly obvious. So that would be grasping after what is not, you know, possible. And it's suffering, isn't it? Now, we've all done it 50,000 times and continue to. Right? So that's what it's talking about. The root meaning is foundation, basis, ground of upadi. In the commentaries, various kinds of upadi are enumerated. Among them, the five aggregates, objects of sensual pleasure, defilements, and kama, actions. Jnani Mula renders the term consistently throughout as essentials of existence. But in this particular case, the present translator doesn't feel that gives the specific connotations about how it's being used in this sutra. So he says, Jnani Mula renders the term consistently throughout as essentials of existence, which often obscures its clear contextual meaning. In context, I have tried to capture the several connotations of the word by rendering it objects of attachment. So he says, where is that footnote? These objects of attachment. Yeah. In paragraph 6. Mm-hmm. Okay. Gold and silver are subject to birth. these objects of attachment, and then he's explaining why he has changed the wording slightly from the traditional way of translating it. And I think it's worth pointing that out, because it's, you know, very often, when we always have this feeling of longing or dissatisfaction, don't we? There's always something missing. You know, you breathe in, you have to breathe out, damn. You breathe out, you have to, damn. You eat, then your stomach has to digest. You wake up, and then, you know, you have to go pee. Is that true? There's always this kind of continuous kind of dissatisfaction, and there are periods in life where it gets very big. You know, where there are extreme trauma things, right? We've all had one or two of those. So then to try to make it different than it is, does that help the suffering? Does it? I'm not saying you fall into it and become a victim, but I'm saying like to really try to make it different than it is. And so that's what he's saying. Two kinds of search, the noble and the ignoble. Mm-hmm. The ignoble search, being himself subject to birth, illness, old age, blah, 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 seeks what is also subject to. Looking in a state of imperfection, looking for imperfection, rather than saying, okay, in this imperfection, what is there? Does that make sense? Okay, what part? Where did I lose you, my dear?
Well, I don't quite understand when he says these things, like subject to birth, seeks what is also subject to birth.
So every day, you could say you're subject to birth, couldn't you? Every day, there's something more, a new you comes up that has to do this or has to do that, right?
Yeah.
Like yesterday, Kathy and Pat were coming out of retreat in Didsbury. They didn't have to worry about phone calls or family or, you know, bills or whether the appliances were working or, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then today, they're born into a whole new world. Right? Out of nowhere. And seeking for something that would just make it go away. Seeking for something rather than looking directly and saying, oh yeah, there is dissatisfactoriness. Does that make sense?
That makes sense, yes.
That's what he's saying.
Okay.
That's what he's saying.
In other words, it's sort of like, well, this is how it is. Things aren't perfect, but so here they are. This is how it is. So that's normal.
But to be able to say that with a sense of interest, so that one is present to what is possible, because you cannot search for what is possible if you're trying to avoid what is unavoidable.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's the point. If you're trying to avoid what is unavoidable, you cannot search for what is possible.
Mm-hmm.
Because one part of your mind is totally tied up in that wall that you've put up. And so there is a part of you that's always traumatized about maybe it will bite me, and so you start getting ruled by fear or by despair or by, you know. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does that make sense? Because we all do it, don't we? I mean, is there anybody in this room who hasn't done that at least 5,933 times this year? And it's only March? We all do it, don't we?
Well, sometimes you don't realize you're doing it.
And that's exactly right. It happens all the time. But then you catch yourself, and most of the time it's quite easy. Oh, that's not possible. Okay. Well, what can I do? Right? But some of the big ones, you don't, it's too scary to look at, isn't it? It takes a while before you You know, because they're gonna look at you if you don't look at them. So we all know that from our lives, don't we? Don't we know that from our lives? The thing you're most trying to ignore is gonna bite you in the ass sometime or other. I mean, it's guaranteed. You know, a little more grace if you look at it first, just before his teeth get bared. Oh, hi. How will I work with this? What is possible here? Any other? It is probably one of the most interesting points, I think, that in Buddhism, this is really the point. It isn't that there's, you know, you're evil or there's something wrong or you deserved it or it's your karma in the way that that's usually. It is our karma. It is our karma. We're born into a body. Immediately there's billions of things that are left out. As soon as you're this genetic mix, you're not 50,000 others. Like, yeah. So you're more prone to this disease, right, but not that disease. Like, yeah. So it's like your action. That's how you were took birth for whatever benefit, you know, you could be in the universe. That's not the point. But it's not yours. You know, you're not the one who invented jeans this week. And I'm not talking about Levi's. Are you? But this is what you do have, also like to bitch about what it isn't doing, stops you from finding out for the moment that you've got it. What does it do? What is possible?
We do act like we invented ourselves, don't we?
We do, don't we?
Yeah. I just realized that.
And that's why I love the Book of Job. Because, you know, that Yahweh and Job have a really nice little discussion about that. And Yahweh says, ask of the birds and they shall teach you. And the beasts in the field and they shall teach you. And the flowers and they shall teach you. Yeah. It's beautiful. Depends on which translation, of course. But I, you know, many times when I actually have time on my day off, you know, over the years, I go and pick out one of my several translations of the Bible, and I just love reading that one about the beauty of the earth. You know, where first God says, "Where were you when I created the heavens?" And you know, and when I made the behemoth or whatever he's called, you know, and where were you then? And like goes on and on, and like after a while, you start saying, "Yeah, geez, how did those things arise?" And when that question comes up, well, ask of the birds, ask. You know, look out, don't look in that way you're looking. Look for the mystery, not for what it should be. Don't look for the answer that you think it should be. Look for the question that will liberate you. Nice, eh? Now that's the difference between the noble search and the ignoble search, right there. If we're trying to make ourselves perfect, well, that's like the ignoble search. But if we acknowledge our imperfection and we all agree that we have a shared aspiration, between all of us, our aspiration will create a fire of desire that will open all our eyes. That's called Sangha. Isn't it? Now I'm preaching, I better get back to this.
Yeah, you sounded like a...
Amen.
That's okay.
But it's true, isn't
it's
it?
Right. Yeah.
Because we're imperfect, we help each other. Because if any of us were perfect, we wouldn't be helping each other, would we? In mysticism, in the West, Western mysticism, the ninth stage is perfection, and the tenth stage is completion. Perfection is not the end. That's like a moment where you understand beyond self-grasping and then back into name and form. In the 16 stages of insight, the 15th stage is total awakening, 16 stages back into name and form. In all the teachings, if you look at them, if you're trying for perfection, you got the wrong idea, buddy. You want to go for seeing how this is a completion of a universal desire. And this is a completion of a personal desire. And they work together in a beautiful dance. That's the point. What else could be enlightenment? Universal mind in an individual body, in a universal body, in an individual mind, boom, 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 boom. No duality. What does that mean? Union. Union with what?
Yep.
Whatever. How could there be fear then? You know, if we were truly lovers, God, I am preaching tonight. If we were truly lovers, wouldn't that just make things interesting? Wouldn't that just make things interesting?
So that's what he's talking about here, eh? Let's get back to the B here.
Our text says acquisitions. It really puts a different flavor on it when they change the word.
Oh, yeah.
Instead of attachment.
Yeah, it says acquisition.
That's really
these cool. Objects of attachment. These objects of acquisition. Well, yeah, they have a sort of...
Well, just
you
it
know,
doesn't even say objects of acquisition. It just says acquisitions.
Yeah, so that's what he's talking about here.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm saying.
That's kind of a loaded word in our English, isn't it?
Yeah, it seems
to
me.
It has to do with greed and collecting and land grabbing. And
so you can see why I'm spending so much time on this point, which I didn't the first time around. It's really straightforward and when you actually just look directly at it. You don't let your hope and fear, objects of attachment.
Yeah.
And it's a mental object of attachment. Isn't it? Well, it probably has some physical basis too, but it's the mind that agrees with the physical. Like when you die, I was just with a friend, well she was, you know, a friend who was dying called and asked me if, you know, actually told me she was very ill and asked if I could come out, so I was in Toronto for a week with her. And just like saying to her and to her husband and her children, when you die, the energy of the speech body, the energy, the container and the contained, you know, the container and the contained have to undo their seams with each other. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
That their bridges, their hooks, whatever you want to call it, their, you know, those little fastener hooks for clothes, they have to undo them. It's not quite as soft as Velcro, though. It's really more like a hook.
Like a wire mesh fence, that way that...
It's like they have to undo, and so there is pain. There is pain when you die. But if you're not trying for what isn't present, your mental state does not have to be involved in it painfully. Because there are two feelings, right? Physical, what are they?
Pleasure and pain.
Three feelings, right? Mentally, what are they?
Like, dislike, and neutral.
Like, dislike, and neutral. You teach yourself with the... Because when there's physical pain or something you don't like mentally, then you can feel your body close up, like the TV, right? And then the body doesn't like that, so it aggravates it both ways. But if you're neutral about that, it's an adventure, right? And when the hooks start untying and the pain is there, if you can bring your mind underneath the usual habitual reaction and just think to yourself, this is the process of leaving the container and the contained moving apart after a beautiful service together. after a beautiful service together, it's time for them to go different directions, right? And you bring your mind to the neutral of being interested in how it's happening. Even a minute before, it was painful. And now you're aware of the physical sensation, and you could see that it could be called painful. But there's this neutral point that you go into that is the gateway to the best way to leave a body. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what else is there to learn? It isn't that there aren't physically unpleasant things. It's that you're not subject to them until you agree to dislike them. There is suffering, says the Buddha, but no one suffering. Because there is pleasure, like, dislike, and neutral, mental, you train yourself, when you see what you like, find something you dislike in it, you see something you dislike. How many times have you heard this from me?
Mm.
Boring. Find something you like in it, and I mean it. Then you start finding where the neutral is. You tell me a circumstance in your life that would not be useful in. And I'll tell you, you're not looking deeply enough. Does that make sense? Because
mm-hmm.
we're so hot on the I and how we should have opinions, and aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
We always got our I dressed up, don't we? Huh? Or our standards from our family, you know. Don't we? Or what we've learned from our own experience, you know.
Mm.
Of course, I'm not talking about anybody else here. Right? But can you also see the speaker and be neutral with that and just watch the speech? And if you can do that, you're going to sail through death, rebirth, and you'll actually be my teacher next time around. And you'll probably deserve it.
Can you repeat that one again?
Which part?
The part about motoring through, what you have to motor through with.
Because what somebody lent Harry your glasses. God's sake. He's squinting at me. What is it? Did you want it, or is that a joke?
No.
That, like, to discover that neutral point in the mind, which we usually use as indifference, which is just another way of putting up a wall, isn't it? Because of fear, isn't it? But instead of that, to bring it into the feeling and be neutral, to teach yourself to be present when you dislike something or like something, and with your mind be interested in how like or dislike move your body. That makes sense? And just be curious about what rights you have in your own being, because you don't have a lot of rights about, you know, when you were born or what your parents were doing when you were three, or, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But you have rights within your skin. To start. And the number one way of understanding what your powers are is by really exploring like and dislike and neutral. If you do that, then dying makes things much easier. And that's part of our career choice, whether we like to look at that page or not. It's not easy to attain what they call in Buddhism freedom from dissatisfactoriness. So it's not likely that I'm going to do it this lifetime. But it is likely that if I really want to see whether that's possible, not only for myself, but for all beings, and so far it's been quite useful in my life, and seems to be useful in other people's lives, then I want to be in a neutral state so that those states of like and dislike don't blow me away at death, rebirth, right? So I want to keep that aspiration and develop the neutral mind so that whoever it is that's going to get on this horse when I get off can keep riding without losing too much territory. That makes sense? So I would hate to see whoever gets on this horse after I get off have to go through the stuff I stupidly went through in my adolescence. Or some of those other years you've heard about. Is that good?
I just have one question. You said keep that aspiration. So the aspiration would be to
for
be
me personally.
Neutral. Keep the aspiration of being neutral.
No, practice the neutral. And keep my aspiration of what is important to me this life. Dharma for me. Dharma. Dharma is absolutely important for me. And you notice, all my friends, it's about Dharma. My relationships with people, always about Dharma. Everything in my life is Dharma. How I live, Dharma. My favorite books, Dharma. Other than solitaire on the computer when I'm talking to people, my favorite things on the computer, Dharma talks. So I like keep that aspiration and make a habit of neutral mind. So that the aspiration, you know, sometime we'll do a whole thing on death. Is that interesting to you?
Mm-hmm.
Sometime we'll do an exploration of death and rebirth. But essentially, the teaching on death, rebirth is at the moment of the body, mind actually parting, the rebirth linking karma, it's called, every moment right now, each thought that you have comes from the previous moment, right? Depending on how you have thought or felt in the past, colors, how you're listening or hearing now. Right? So there is a habituated continuum. It is not the same, but it's habituated based on like and dislike from the past. Isn't that pretty straightforward?
Mm-hmm.
So that at death, so they go like dissolution, rebirth, dissolution, rebirth, like boom, 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 really fast, the thought moments, really fast. 17 times the speed of matter or something. I don't know. Some amount. Or light or something. I don't know. But at death, what happens is there is the seed that would create the next moment of thought comes up, which is called rebirth linking karma. But then it doesn't complete while in this body. It completes when you've left this body in an energy body. So that the next moment of thought is when you're on the other side. You've had near-death experiences. You have some inkling of what I'm talking about. And it's not exactly the same, but it gives you some feeling of what I'm talking about. And so what creates the rebirth linking thought, which is the most important thing to pay attention to, is your habits. The habituated states of this life are the strongest impulse for rebirth. So if you have, you know, made a habit of preferring to watch the negative and see whether you can see something positive in it, so that you're not just, when you like something, you immediately turn on, and when you dislike something, you immediately turn off. You know, some of you, I'm on you about that all the time, because it's really important. That's why I'm on you about it. And does that make sense? If you have actually taught yourself to like just look at that state and not believe it is self and just automatically salute, that because consciousness prefers wholesome to unwholesome, and that's more wholesome, it becomes a habit very quickly. Mm-hmm. So even if you practice that for a week pretty consistently before you had a death rebirth experience, it would become a habit that would affect your death rebirth. Number one. The second thing that affects death rebirth is what they call a heavy action. Murder.
jhana, an experience of total bliss absorption. Any heavy action that totally marks, traumatizes, whatever you want to say, if you could use traumatize for a positive, that would work.
So it's a positive or negative.
Yeah, it's right. Called a heavy action.
Oh, okay.
You mean it's happened any time in your life?
Any time in your life. And it will have an effect on. So it's either habitual or a heavy action that creates the next moment.
What happens if you've had both? Positive and negative heavy actions.
I guess you're reborn as Siamese twins. Don't go there right now.
Okay.
We're not doing it.
All right.
This is a cardboard outline.
This is the flavor.
This is a non-working model.
Right.
But maybe Siamese twins.
Probably
in different directions.
Maybe that's when you get, like, twin twins.
Is that okay for now? So, where were we?
Acquisitions.
Seven.
Okay.
Six, seven.
Seven.
These objects of attachment are subject to birth. Do you want to make a little note of attachment in the margin there? Or mm-hmm. somebody's pencil if you do.
What number are we on?
On page 254 in my book. Is it 254 in your book?
Yeah.
Objects of attachment. Number 6, the footnote is number 299 beside objects of attachment, which started us off on this long sermon, are subject to birth. And one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to birth, seeks what is also subject to birth. That's pretty straightforward, right? Mm. And what may be said to be subject to aging? Wife and children are subject to aging. Men and women are slaves, goats, and sheep. See, he was talking to men, so he couldn't say husbands and children. You know, he couldn't say that. Goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses, mares, gold and silver are subject to aging. These objects of attachment are subject to aging. And one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to aging, seeks what is also subject to aging. And what may be said to be subject to sickness? Wife and children are subject to sickness. Men and women, slaves, goats and sheep, fowls and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares are subject to sickness. These objects of attachment are subject to sickness. And one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them, and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to sickness, seeks what is also subject to sickness. And what may be said to be subject to death? Wife and children are subject to death. Men and women, slaves, goats and sheep, fowls and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares are subject to death. These objects of attachment are subject to death, and one who is tied to them, infatuated with them, and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to death, seeks what is also subject to death. And what may be subject to sorrow? Wife and children are subject to sorrow. Men and women, slaves, goats and sheep, fowls and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares are subject to sorrow. These objects of attachment are subject to sorrow. And one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to sorrow, seeks what is also subject to sorrow. And what may be said to be subject to defilement? Wife and children are subject to defilement. Men and women, slaves, goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses and mares, gold and silver are subject to defilement. These objects of attachment are subject to defilement, and one who is tied to these things, infatuated with them and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to defilement, seeks what is also subject to defilement. This is the ignoble search. And what is the noble search? Here's someone being himself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeks the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being himself subject to aging, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, he seeks the unaging supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being himself subject to sickness,
having understood the danger in what is subject to sickness. He seeks the unfailing supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being himself subject to death, having understood the danger in what is subject to death, he seeks the deathless supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being himself subject to sorrow, having understood the danger in what is subject to sorrow, he seeks the sorrowless supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being himself subject to defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to defilement, he seeks the undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana. That's the noble search. So how do you do it? So then the bhikkhus, then the Buddha says, bhikkhus, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I too, being myself subject to birth, sought what was also subject to birth. Being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, I sought what was also subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement. Then I considered thus, why, being myself subject to birth, do I seek what is subject to birth? Why, being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, do I seek what is also subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement? Suppose that, being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, I seek the unborn supreme security from bondage. And he didn't know nibbana then. He's saying, I started looking to see if there was another doorway, basically, because he didn't know. Like, that's the point to me. He knew what wasn't going to work. And he didn't negate that. He didn't ignore that. He didn't deny that. He said, okay, is there something I'm not seeing here? Is there something else? Other than my habitual reaction, what else is possible? Isn't that neat?
Hmm.
Suppose that being myself subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, I seek something that is unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, and undefiled, supreme security from bondage, nibbana. The going out of aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement. That's what nibbana means, gone out. Is there something that is not subject to those, where that subjection is gone out? That's what he's looking for. And so there is dissatisfactoriness, but no one dissatisfactory. No one caught in it.
So he's not negating that there's death or sorrow or any of those things. He's saying there is the possibility of negating the subjection.
Yeah. He said, not possibility, he said there is.
Yes.
No one subject to.
No one subject to.
That was one of his early definitions in his teaching of nibbana. There is dukkha, but no one subject to dukkha. The first few times I heard that, I thought I understood it.
But since a lot
of... And then I tried to figure out who that I was.
But since a lot of people seem to suffer a lot, he's not implying that they're choosing to suffer or anything like that.
Or that they're not choosing.
Or they're not.
That they're caught in ignorance. If you ignore, you don't see.
Yeah.
In order to manifest, you have to ignore, but you can be conscious of that ignoring. I don't want to go there. I want to finish this. Later, while still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessing of youth. In the prime of life, though my mother and father, not to mention his wife and son, wished otherwise, and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness. Having gone forth, bhikkhus, in search of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I went to Alara Kalama and said to him, "Friend Kalama, I want to lead the holy life in this Dhamma and discipline." Alara Kalama replied, "The Venerable One may stay here. This Dhamma is such that a wise man can soon enter upon and abide in it, realizing for himself, through direct knowledge, his own teacher's doctrine. I soon quickly learned that Dhamma. As far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal of his teaching went, I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed, I know and see. And there were others who did likewise. I considered, it is not through mere faith alone that Alara Kalama declares, by realizing for myself with direct knowledge, I enter upon and abide in this Dhamma. Certainly, Alara Kalama abides knowing and seeing this Dhamma, not just intellectually understanding it, right? Then I went to Alara Kalama and asked him, "Friend Kalama, in what way do you declare that by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge you enter upon and abide in this Dhamma?" In reply, he declared the basis of nothingness. Okay, that's a footnote, number 301. He taught him the seven attainments of serenity meditation, or the seven jhanas, seven of the eight jhanas, ending in the base of nothingness or nothingness, the third of the four immaterial attainments. Through these attainments, though these attainments are spiritually exalted, they are still mundane and not in themselves directly conducive to nirvana, not in themselves. They are very useful, especially for some people, because you have a direct, clear perception of consciousness without duality in the formless jhanas. So you understand how it is that you are conscious without subject-object. Subject-object are like heavy cloaks you put on when it's 90 above. That makes sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
That analogy works?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So they're not necessary for nirvana, but for some people it is really useful to practice jhana until they have enough experiences of those states of the higher jhanas where there is no subject-object. Formless jhanas are called sometimes because they're not form, subject-object, formless experiences. So that you really clearly comprehend that subject-object duality is not permanent, it's not a fixed identity, and it's subject to dissolution, and you can actually watch self changing through a day and feel comfortable in that. That's one of the three ways to learn it, through jhana, right? I've talked about that many times before, and so that's enough. So, I considered, in reply he declared the base of nothingness. I considered, not only Alara Kalama has faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Well, I could see his qualities and how he could do that practice, but I have those qualities too, so I could do it. Suppose I endeavor to realize the Dhamma that Alara Kalama declares he enters upon. See how commonsensical he is? And abides in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. I soon quickly entered upon and abided in that Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. So I tried it out and it worked. That's what he's saying, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I had that experience. Then I went to Alara Kalama and asked him, "Friend Kalama, is this a way that you declare that you enter upon and abide in the Dhamma by realizing for yourself direct knowledge?"
I like to think then he went poof. And then he went poof. And then he came back. Is that it? And the friend Kalama said, "That's the way, friend. It is in this way, friend, that I also enter upon and abide in this Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. It is a gain for us, friend. It is a great gain for us that we have such a venerable one for our companion in the holy life. So the Dhamma that I declare I enter upon and abide in by realizing for myself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge. And the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself direct knowledge is the Dhamma that I declare I enter upon and abide in by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. So you know the Dhamma that I know, and I know the Dhamma that you know. As I am, so are you. As you are, so am I. Come, friend, let us now lead this community together." Thus Alara Kalama, my teacher, placed me, his pupil, on an equal footing with himself and awarded me the highest honor. But it occurred to me, this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana, but only to reappearance in the base of nothingness. Following that, then there is the ability to see beyond the usual perceptions of your lifetime and to realize that although there is a state and one can enter into and abide in formless jhana, I am presuming I have fallen into it on one occasion. I fell into it and came out of it 3 hours later. But I didn't know how I got there, and I didn't know why the time was so different, and how it lit some marijuana in the room because I was so happy. You know, and it took me a long time to realize, oh, yeah, geez, 3 hours have passed. You know? But that it can last for long periods of time. And your body will still survive unless it's eaten by a tiger. And it can last for long periods of time. And in fact, it is easy for you to just cut the contact with the body and go into a state of dwelling in that state. But at some point, you always come out of that state. Because it's dependent upon exercises of concentration. It's something that is made from many conditions, right? You have to actually create it. So anything that is created is subject to dissolution. Mm-hmm. So he's saying, so, you know, you could get there, you could get into that state, and maybe you could be there for a very long time. But at some point, it's going to lead to a lower state. It's not an end state. It's still something that's subject to grasping. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And and it's quite pleasant, so it's particularly subject to grasping.
So it's like a god realm.
Yeah, it is a god realm, exactly. One of the highest god realms. Mm-hmm. But only to reappearance in the base of nothingness. The only thing it leads to is going back there again and again and again. So it's just a slightly better, slightly classier form of samsara. Not being satisfied with that Dhamma, I left it, went away. Still in search, bhikkhus, of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I went to Uddaka Ramaputta and said to him, "Friend, I want to lead the holy life in this Dhamma and discipline." 303. In both Horner and MLS and Yanimola and MS Mayer in their translation of the account of the Bodhisattva's meeting with Uddaka Ramaputta by assuming that Uddaka is identical with Rama. However, as his name indicates, Uddaka was the son, Putta, of Rama, either biological or spiritual. Rama himself must have already passed away before the Bodhisattva arrived on the scene. Should be noted that all references to Rama are in past tense in the third person. Uddaka, in the end, places the Bodhisattva in the position of teacher.
Though the text does not allow for definite conclusions, this suggests that he himself had not yet reached the fourth immaterial attainment, that Udaka had not reached the fourth immaterial attainment. Udaka Ramaputta replied, "The Venerable One may stay here. The Dhamma is such that a wise man can soon enter upon and abide in it, himself realizing through direct knowledge his own teacher's doctrine. I soon quickly learned that Dhamma as far as mere lip reciting and rehearsal of his teaching went. I could speak with knowledge and assurance, and I claimed, I know and see, and there were others who did likewise. I considered, it was not through mere faith alone that Rama declared, by realizing for myself with direct knowledge, I enter upon and abide in this Dhamma. Certainly Rama abided knowing and seeing this Dhamma. Then I went to Udaka Ramaputta and asked him, Friend, in what way did Rama declare that by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, he entered upon and abided in this Dhamma? In reply, Udaka Ramaputta declared the base of neither perception nor non-perception. The eighth jhana, the fourth form of jhana. I considered not only Rama had faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. I too have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Suppose I endeavor to realize the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and abided in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. I soon quickly entered upon and abided in that Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. Then I went to Udaka Ramaputta and asked him, Friend, was it in this way that Rama declared that he entered upon and abided in this Dhamma by realizing for himself with direct knowledge? Dash. That is the way, friend. Dash. It is in this way, friend, that I also enter upon and abide in this Dhamma by realizing for myself with direct knowledge. Dash. It is a gain for us, friend. It is a great gain for us that we have such a venerable one for our companion in the holy life. So the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and abided in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge. And the Dhamma that you enter upon and abide in by realizing for yourself with direct knowledge is the Dhamma that Rama declared he entered upon and abided in by realizing for himself with direct knowledge. So you know the Dhamma that Rama knew, and Rama knew the Dhamma that you know. And Rama, as Rama was, so are you. As you are, so was Rama. Come, friend, now lead this community. Thus, Udaka Ramaputta, my companion in the holy life, placed me in the position of a teacher and accorded me the highest honor. But occurred to me, this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion. Right? Back into that, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana, but only to reappearance in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Not being satisfied with this Dhamma, I left it and went away. Still in search, bhikkhus, of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of supreme sublime bliss, I wandered by stages through the Magadhan country until eventually I arrived at Senanigama near Uruvila. There I saw an agreeable piece of ground, a delightful grove with a clear flowing river with pleasant smooth banks, and nearby a village for alms resort. I considered, this is an agreeable piece of ground, this is a delightful grove with a clear flowing river with pleasant smooth banks, and nearby a village for alms resort. This will serve for the striving of a clansman intent on striving. And I sat down there thinking, this will serve for striving. Majjhima Nikaya 36 includes the account of the Bodhisattva's meeting with Alara, Kalama, and Udaka Ramaputta, and then continues from this point with the story of the extreme ascetic practices that brought him to the verge of death and his subsequent discovery of the middle way that led to enlightenment, which are left out of this particular time that they're in the number 36, which we'll get to later. Enlightenment. Then bhikkhus, being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeking the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the unborn supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being myself subject to aging, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, seeking the unaging supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the unaging supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being myself subject to sickness, having understood the danger in what is subject to sickness, seeking the ailing supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the unailing supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being myself subject to death, having understood the danger in what is subject to death, seeking the deathless supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the deathless supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being myself subject to sorrow, having understood the danger in what is subject to sorrow, seeking the sorrowless supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the sorrowless supreme security from bondage, nibbana. Being myself subject to defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to defilement, seeking the undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana, I attained the undefiled supreme security from bondage, nibbana. The knowledge and vision arose in me. My deliverance is unshakable. This is my last birth. Now there is no renewal of being. I considered, this Dhamma that I have attained is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle, to be experienced by the wise. 305. M.A. identifies this Dhamma with the Four Noble Truths, the true truths or states, Kana, spoken of just below dependent origination in Nibbana, are the truths of the origin of suffering and the cessation of suffering, which respectively imply the truths of suffering in the path. So first is that there is suffering, and then there is the origins, and then there is a cessation, and then the path and the Four Noble Truths. But these two that are talked about next are just the origins and the cessation. It is hard for such a generation to see this, but this generation delights in worldliness, takes delight in worldliness, rejoices in worldliness. And 306, Alaya. It is difficult to find for this word a suitable English equivalent that has not already been assigned to a more frequently occurring term. Horner renders it as sensual pleasure, which appropriates the usual rendering of kama, and may be too narrow. In MS and in other published works, Nyanamoli translated as something to rely on, which may draw upon a connotation of the word that is not the one intended here. M.A. explains alaya as comprising both objective sense pleasure and the thoughts of craving concerned with them. Thus, worldliness has been chosen as sharing this twofold meaning of the original. So both in the mind's view of sensual pleasure and the physical experience of sensual pleasure, alaya. But this generation delights in worldliness, takes delight in worldliness, rejoices in worldliness. It is hard for such a generation to see this truth. Delights in sensual pleasure, continuously shopping for sensual pleasure. It's hard for this generation, such a generation, to see this truth, namely specific conditionality, dependent origination. Dependent on this arises. Dependent on this arises, right? And it is hard to see this truth, namely the stilling of all formations. It is hard to see the truth of the origins of dissatisfactoriness, and it's hard to see the truth of the cessation.
Why would it be difficult to see something?
Because
the cessation would have to be
for both of them, some people, they see origins easily, they don't see the cessation, and that's where I have the insight that brings them to a path realization. Some people see cessation and they don't see origins. Some people see suffering. A couple of my teachers taught me that. One of them was Ananda Bodhi, and another was Achyutamitaro in Thailand. That there are, different people, for people there are different paths that are, some people really see something arising, the suffering, some people see it, the cessation. Some people do well in the morning for thinking about their plans, some people do well in the evening going back reviewing, you know?
Mm.
And some people are good at the middle, in noon. There are different minds that are attuned differently to see something.
To see the situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, cool.
So that's what he's saying here. Just this generation delights in worldliness, takes delights in worldliness, rejoices in worldliness. It's hard for such a generation to see this truth of dependent arising, which is the truth of the origins of suffering. And it is hard to see the truth of the cessation of suffering for this generation. Some of them wouldn't see the origin, some of them wouldn't see the cessation. Right?
Hmm.
There isn't an easy way to teach them this. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay, thanks. And it's hard to see this truth, namely the stealing of all formations, the relinquishing of all attachments, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nirvana. If I were to teach the Dhamma, others would not understand me, and that would be wearying and troublesome for me. I, of course, naturally have a question right there, but I'm not going to ask it because we just have time to catch up to where we left off last time. Thereupon, there came to me spontaneously these stanzas never heard before. Enough with teaching the Dhamma that even I found hard to reach, for it will never be perceived by those who live in lust and hate. Those died in lust, wrapped in darkness, will never discern this abstruse Dhamma, which goes against the worldly stream, subtle, deep, and difficult to see. Considering thus, my mind inclined to inaction rather than to teaching the Dhamma. 307. M.A. raises the question, why, when the Bodhisattva had long ago made an aspiration to reach Buddhahood in order to liberate others, is mind now inclined toward inaction? The reason, the commentator says, is that only now, after reaching enlightenment, did he become fully cognizant of the strength of the defilements in people's minds and of the profundity of the Dhamma, of the gap between the two. Also, he wanted Brahma to entreat him to teach so that beings who venerated Brahma would recognize the precious value of the Dhamma and desire to listen to it. Then, bhikkhus, the Brahma Sahampati knew with his mind the thought in my mind. Brahma is like a god realm, so this god realm being. And he considered the world will be lost, the world will perish, since the mind of the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened, inclines to inaction rather than teaching the Dhamma. Then just as quickly as a strong man might extend his flexed arm or flex his extended arm, the Brahma Sahampati vanished in the Brahma world and appeared before me. He arranged his upper robe on one shoulder, extending his hands in reverential salutation toward me, said, Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma. Let the Sublime One teach the Dhamma. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who are wasting through not hearing the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand the Dhamma. The Brahma Sahampati spoke thus, and then he said further, In Magadha there have appeared till now impure teachings devised by those still stained. Open the doors to the deathless. Let them hear the Dhamma that the stainless one has found. Just as one who stands on a mountain peak can see below the people all around, so, O wise one, all-seeing sage, ascend the palace of the Dhamma. Let the sorrowless one survey this human breed engulfed in sorrow, overcome by birth and old age. Arise, victorious hero, caravan leader, debtless one, and wander in the world. Let the blessed one teach the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand. Then I listened to the Brahma's pleading, and out of compassion for beings, I surveyed the world with the eye of a Buddha. Surveying the world with the eye of a Buddha, I saw beings with little dust in their eyes, and with much dust in their eyes, with keen faculties and with dull faculties, with good faculties and with good qualities and with bad qualities, easy to teach and hard to teach, and some who dwelt seeing fear in blame and in the other world, just as in a pond of blue or red or white lotuses. Some lotuses that are born and grow in the water thrive immersed in the water without rising out of it. And some other lotuses that are born and grow in the water rest on the water's surface. And some other lotuses that are born and grow in the water rise out of the water and stand clear, unwetted by it. So too, surveying the world with the eye of a Buddha, I saw beings with little dust in their eyes and with much dust in their eyes, with keen faculties and dull faculties, with good qualities and with bad qualities, easy to teach and hard to teach, and some who dwelt seeing fear and blame, and in the other world. Then I replied to the Brahma, Sahampati, in these in stanzas. Open for them are the doors to the deathless. Let those with ears now show their faith. Thinking it would be troublesome, O Brahma, I did not speak the Dhamma, sublime and subtle and sublime. Then the Brahma Sahampati thought, I have created the opportunity for the Blessed One to teach the Dhamma, and after paying homage to me, kept me on the right. He thereupon departed at once. I considered thus, to whom should I first teach the Dhamma? Who will understand this Dhamma quickly? It then occurred to me, Alara Kalama is wise, intelligent, and discerning. He has long had little dust in his eyes. Suppose I taught the Dhamma first to Alara Kalama. He will understand it quickly. Then deities approached me and said, Venerable Sir, Alara Kalama died 7 days ago. And the knowledge and vision arose in me. Alara Kalama died 7 days ago. I thought, Alara Kalama's loss is a great one. If he had learned this Dhamma, he would have understood it quickly. I considered thus, to whom should I first teach the Dhamma? Who will understand this teaching quickly? It then occurred to me, Uddhaka Dharmaputta is wise, intelligent, and discerning. He has long had little dust in his eyes. Suppose I taught the Dhamma first to Uddhaka Dharmaputta. He will understand it quickly. Then deities approached me and said, Venerable Sir, Uddhaka Dharmaputta died last night. And the knowledge and vision arose in me, Uddhaka Dharmaputta died last night. I thought, Uddhaka Dharmaputta's loss is a great one. If he had heard this Dhamma, he would have understood it quickly. I considered thus, to whom should I first teach the Dhamma? Who will understand this Dhamma quickly? It then occurred to me, the bhikkhus of the group of five who attended upon me while I was engaged in my striving were very helpful. 308. These five monks attended on the Bodhisattva during his period of self-mortification, convinced that he would attain enlightenment and teach them the Dhamma. However, when he abandoned his austerities and resumed taking solid food, they lost faith in him, accused him of reverting to luxury, and deserted him. Suppose I taught the Dhamma first to them, then I thought, where are the bhikkhus of the group of five now living? And with the divine eye which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw that they were living at Benares in the deer park at Isipatana. And if you want to know what happened next, come next month. Or read your own copy. Do you have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints? We actually got a little further than we did last time. Are you enjoying these?
Yes, sir. Yes, very much.
It took me a long time to be able to read them because I was so biased. about what I could read or what I couldn't, you know. And when I finally saw my own bias and actually just tried just reading them, I was so surprised at how beautiful they are. Mm. And that wasn't even such a good translation as this one. And how many times I would stop in the middle one and close the book and then go back and read it, the same thing, you know, for like a week. I just walk around muttering it to myself as I walked around the city of Toronto, you know, mutter, 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 repeating the lines, and how that grew me in a way that, you know, was so beautiful. There's something about the way this teaching is explained that isn't about what you believe in. It's about what you're willing to look in yourself to see if it's true. Mm-hmm. And I found that at that time, and I find it today a great comfort to be seen for oneself. But you see the confidence you have to be willing to look for yourself. You have to have confidence, don't you? You have to think you got rights. And isn't that interesting? And so, like he was saying about the people that wouldn't hear, the ones who would be most like the lotus that opens underwater, they're caught in fear and how others would perceive them.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have the confidence, they're not above that, to actually say, well, what is that fear, even? How powerful, you know, this teaching. To be seen for yourself, but like nobody else can give you the way to see it, except can say to you, you can see this for yourself. But you're the one who has to decide that you can do that. And not everybody will. Just when you want them to, or, you know, you do, or they should, or, you know? Mm-hmm. So therefore, you learn compassion. It's a really nice thing to learn.
Mm-hmm.
I usually learn it by being pissed off first, but then well, maybe I should just say it louder. Well, maybe I need to be more articulate. Well, maybe well, maybe I haven't learned it. Oops. Why do I want somebody else to believe in? You know?
Mm.
Interesting question, isn't it?
Because you find it really valuable, and when you find something valuable, you really want to share it with people.
Well, there's a difference between wanting to share it with people or wanting people to hear it.
Mm.
You know?
Is that the dilemma the Buddha had too?
Yeah, which is what he was saying. Mm. He was looking for people who could hear it. Because he would want to share it with everybody, but who could hear it? You know, so then the difference between the people I want to hear it versus the people who do want to hear it. And that's a real learning curve, isn't it?
Mm.
You know what new converts are like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is it that happens? You feel kind of pushed because there isn't a sense of them respecting your space. Isn't that true? That's where the compassion part comes in. If somebody can't hear, that doesn't mean that some lifetime they're not gonna, and what they're learning now is valid for that. Isn't it? But I'm still glad the Buddha taught. So, is that it then? Thank you very much. You notice that there's a beautiful gold light in your hearts. Spreads through your body, moves through the room. You know what it does, Phil's Edmonton. Anyone you want to pray for, dogs, cats, coyotes in the river, valley, whatever, birds, angels, beings, whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share with our beings. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering. So I do thank you for your great compassion.